We're in Galatians chapter 4, and we have been working our way into the second paragraph, looking at Paul's concept of their past and in contrast with their future or present. He said that they were, at that time, in verse 8, ignorant of God and enslaved to entities that call themselves gods or were given the credit for being gods by those that serve them without having the capacity to function that way. The ultimate futility, serving a god that can't help you. But then in verse 9 he said, but now that you've come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how is it that you turn back again? So we were looking last time at this whole idea of turning back away from the knowledge of God and being known by God, two weak and beggarly elements again. So, this evening what we're going to do is look at the latter two verses of the paragraph, verses 10 and 11, because in those the issue has to do with Paul's evidence for the accusations that he's making. He says you want to turn back again, and he bases it on the verse 10, their observance of days and months and seasons and years. And then his statement that he's afraid in regard to them somehow, that his labor over them would be a vain thing. Because we have considered the reality that God is willing to enter into a real interactive relationship with others, I mean, that's the whole idea of being known by God in a setting where God knows everything. We considered the issues of the words. There is a knowledge that is actual, but it's based on other things, facts and whatnot. But then there is a knowledge that's rooted in the interaction of two persons or more. And that kind of knowledge not even God can have without the relationship. So it's possible for Jesus as the King to say in the judgment, I never knew you, and be telling the truth. Not that he didn't know everything about them, but because they had refused a relationship with him, he couldn't enter into one with them. Therefore, he never had this relational knowledge. And we have looked at the issue of relational knowledge requiring relational interaction. And Paul's statements about you have come to know God and God has come to know you and what that implies. So this evening, what we're going to be doing is looking at what Paul's talking about in terms of the breakdown of that relationship. When he says, you have come to know God, you have become known by God, why are you walking away from that? He's talking about the breakdown of the relational reality. He's talking about cutting off the relational knowledge by shutting down the relationship. And he's accusing them of doing that. So what we're looking at in his accusation that they're turning back again is an accusation that there are some things that can break down the relationship between God and men, and we want to know basically how that works. And that's what verses 10 and 11 are doing. Now, sometimes in the way Paul writes, I find it easier to think in reverse from him. So sometimes I'll take the last thing he says and then work back to the first. And that's what we're going to do this evening. I want to look at verse 11 first, this fear thing, and then back up to verse 10. Because I want to ask the question, what was he really afraid of? The text says in the King James, I am afraid of you. In the New American Standard, it says, I fear for you. The Greek says, I fear you. In other words, the you is a direct object in the Greek language. It's an accusative case, and that means the verb's action is here. So fear has this objective. I fear you. The question is, was he afraid of them? Or was he fearing for them? What does I fear you mean? What was really driving this whole thing? Now, he tells us at one level what his fear is. Possible that I've labored over you in vain. But that's not a final statement. That's a statement of one of the levels. It's true he was afraid that he had labored over them in vain. But that wasn't really the thing he was afraid of. So that's where we're going this evening. I want us to think about what is it that he's afraid of? Because even the translators couldn't decide. I'm afraid of you is one meaning. I am afraid for you is a different meaning. And I fear you is possibly even something else. So that very ambiguity in the translations push us to look for some more clarity in terms of what Paul's actually expressing. And as is the case with almost everything that's ever said, there are layers involved. We use language with multiple figures so that many of the things we say, we mean them by implication in relation to some other things. And that's what I just call layered communication. A lot of times we'll say one thing, mean something a little different than that, but the people we're talking to know exactly what we're saying and implying. Sometimes we say something, the person that hears us say that misunderstands. They take us verbatim, and they don't realize that that's really not the issue. The issue is a little bit more profound than that, but because they're taking it at face value, then they misunderstand us, and they don't know what's going on. So that's what I want us to think about in terms of Paul's statement, verse 11, because it's the last thing in the paragraph that has something to say about this whole issue of why they want to go back to the situation they were originally in, which makes no sense. You cannot rationally defend the idea that you turn to God for life because you were experiencing death, and now that you have gotten some life, you don't want it anymore, you want to go back to death. That's just plumb dumb. It's impossible to logically or rationally validate that. It's impossible. If you want life, then why are you going in the direction of death? And if you didn't want life, what were you so bent out of shape about living in death for? So let me start by saying this in relation to the idea of layers. Technically, Paul wasn't afraid in any sense that makes his experience the bottom line. If you think that he's afraid that he's labored over them in vain is the final statement, so that the issue is, you have wasted my time, you've missed him. That's completely out of the ballpark. That's not where he's going with this. He is not afraid in any sense that makes what happens to him the bottom line. It was his claim and his truth in Romans 9:3 that he was willing to be accursed for those that he loved, even though they hated him. He said in Romans 9 that the Jewish people were out to get his hide, but he was willing to be accursed from Christ for their sake, if it came down to it. So, given that statement in Romans 9:3 as a fact, it was Paul's claim and truth that that's the way he felt about his adversaries, particularly his Jewish brethren adversaries. And therefore, it'd be pretty much impossible to assign to him a very self-centered or self-focused fear in this text, given the fact that his progress in the love of God has already gone beyond that kind of self-focus. So there is a difficulty in this whole issue of how fear and love are related. There is a difficulty in that, but the difficulty does not mean that Paul's experience is the issue. When he says, I am afraid, he is not talking about how he wants us to think about how badly he's being affected in terms of fear. He is telling them that he's afraid in regard to them in some way that has to do with the labor that he labored over them. But the question still is, what was he ultimately afraid of? And how did the fact that they were turning his labor into vanity involved in that whole mix? So we can say technically that he wasn't in any sense afraid that he was going to lose somehow in terms of his labors or whatever. And I said, there is a difficulty here with fear and love, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But just keep that in mind. There is a sense in which if you love, you have to be afraid. Just because you're afraid doesn't necessarily mean you're loving with a biblical love, but it does mean you're loving with some kind of love. Because you wouldn't be afraid if you didn't value something that you thought you were going to lose. But by the same token, you can't claim to love if it doesn't make any difference to you what happens. If you love, fear is almost an inevitability to some degree. So we're going to talk about that. But before we get there, I just want you to start with the assumption that Romans 9:3 is true, that he's not self-focused. Secondly, I think the King James translation that he was afraid of the Galatians is just simply off the wall. That's not, technically, he's not afraid of them. Being afraid of them would imply that they might have something they could damage him in some way that he might be afraid of. I don't think that's it. The issue of his fears is stated here in verse 11. The issue of his fears is, what's going to happen if my labor on your behalf is rendered ineffective? What's going to happen? And you can say, what's going to happen to Paul? You can say, what's going to happen to the Galatians? What's going to happen to God? What's going to happen if my labors over you prove to be vain, ineffective? That's really the area where we have to wrestle with this whole idea. And I don't believe that the issue of Paul's fears is what's going to happen to him if his labors prove ineffective. Because what happens to him is not his concern, fundamentally. What's the worst thing that could happen to him if his labors proved ineffective? Would God say to Paul, well, you didn't succeed here, so here's the penalty? No, that's not going to happen. Because God's never going to hold you accountable for accomplishing something he didn't give you the power to accomplish. So he's never going to hold you accountable for how somebody else responded to something you tried to do good for them. Never. If all your effort went up in smoke in terms of them, God's not going to say, well, you blew it. In order for God to say to you or to me, you blew it, he has to have given us the ability to do it and then have us not do it. If he wanted me to tell somebody about something and I refused, he could say to me, you blew it. But if he wanted them to do something with something that I told them, and I told them, and they didn't do it, well, he's going to come back on me. So what is this issue of being afraid that his efforts are ineffective? And this is where we want to get into this complication. Fears are always about the one who is afraid, to some degree. When he says, I'm afraid, he's describing himself as fearful. For most of us, that means that he's being selfish. You know, 1 John says, perfect love casts out all fear. So if you're afraid, you're just not perfect in love. Well, what if it's love that's making you afraid? If Paul was actually willing, according to Romans 9:3, if Paul was actually willing to be accursed for his brethren's sake, he had to have had a large investment in what those brethren were going to experience. He's not going to say, look, I'll volunteer for eternal death forever for their sake, without having the desire that his suffering on their behalf would affect them in a positive way. Paul is not saying, look, God, send us both to hell. Doesn't really matter to me whether they go to hell or not, but I'll volunteer to go to hell for them even if they're going to go to hell anyway. He's not saying that. Paul isn't volunteering for eternal death for those that are going to go into eternal death. He's volunteering for eternal death if his volunteerism will cause them to come to life. So we have to keep this in mind. Being willing to go into the second death forever on the basis of some rationale means that that rationale is a heavy investment. You've got a lot of investment in this thing if you're willing to pay that kind of price. And that's the whole issue involved in love and the issue of sacrifice. To the degree that you sacrifice, to that degree you love. If your sacrifice is minimal, so is your love. It's not a critical thing. I mean, I'm not criticizing. If something's only worth 2 cents to me, then I'm willing to sacrifice 2 cents. But you got to understand that that's not a big sacrifice, and that means they're not really very important to me. Now, if you've got to pay me 2 cents to take it off your hands, then you can say it's not worth anything to him. He'd rather have the 2 cents and this drag that you've loaded him up with because he wants the 2 cents. But you can't tell me that the thing I got for accepting your 2 cents from you to take it off your hands isn't of any value to me. It's because it's not. If it was a value, I'd be giving you the money. So the issue of love and the level of sacrifice you're willing to make is pretty well directly in line with each other. That's what John 3:16 means. That when God looked at the world and he saw the loss that was going to be the world's if he just let it go, and then he said, am I willing to let that happen? And his answer was, no, I'm not. Okay, what are you willing to pay to keep it from happening? Well, I'll give 3.5 angels. No, that won't work. That's not enough. Okay, I'll give 12 angels and a couple of humans. No, that's not a good enough price. When he says, God so loved the world, he gave his son, he said, my investment here is huge because the payment's huge. So we're talking about here the whole idea of love being an investment in something or someone. And a large investment with a large sacrifice attached has to mean that the thing you're sacrificing for means something to you. And if that doesn't happen, then boy, it's going to affect you. For example, what happens if Paul sends himself to hell forever for the sake of his brethren and then they end up in hell too? Then he could say, my labor was in vain. I didn't get what I wanted out of this. I didn't want you here. That's why I made this sacrifice. What are you doing here? The whole idea is, if you don't get what you want out of the sacrifice that you're making, then it's going to affect you negatively. That's why he says, I'm afraid. So that means that there simply has to be something that can offset the impact of the denial of the extremely deeply held objective. Paul wasn't the first guy that volunteered to go to hell for somebody. Moses set that pattern way back in the Old Testament when God was going to wipe out Israel or a bunch of them, and Moses stepped in the breach and said, forgive their sin, and if you won't, blot me out of the book. With the implication that blotting me out will keep them in. And God says, no, not going to take that. Get out of my way. But God, if I get out of your way and you destroy these people, what's going to happen to me? Because they mean enough to me that I'm willing to go to hell for them. And if that's really something that's in play, then there's got to be something that will come in behind that and say, okay, you can suffer this huge loss because your labor is in vain, because it will not produce what you want it to. So how in the world do you ever have any joy afterwards? Well, you're not, unless there's something that will compensate you in your loss. In other words, if Moses or Paul is willing to go to hell for somebody so that they won't have to, but they do anyway, then the labor, the sacrifice has been in vain. Okay, how do you handle that in relation to them? God, in effect, says no to both of them. You're not going to go to hell forever for anybody. So you're going to go to heaven. The people you want to save are going to go to hell. And there you are, willing to go for them, but they go and you don't. And so how are you supposed to have any joy or any kind of satisfaction after that? You had this huge investment and God just flatly said, no, you're not going to get what you're invested in here. I've heard it said like this. How can anybody be happy in heaven if they see a relative of theirs in hell? That's the question. If you had an investment in that relative, I mean, if you don't care about your relatives and they go to hell, you say, well, that's just what they deserve. But fine. But what if you did care about them? What if you loved them enough to suffer for them instead? What if that was the level of your investment in them? And then they went anyway. Then how are you going to ever handle that in an eternal reality? That's what Paul's driving at in this text. There has to be something that can offset the impact of the denial of the objective. When God says to you, no, but the thing you want is extremely important to you, what does he expect you to do about that? Because Paul says here, I'm afraid. So, the question then has now come to be, what is the something that can offset the impact of the denial? And I believe that that something is identified in the scriptures. In the final analysis, the actual satisfaction of the soul is met by the union of that soul with God, so that in his presence is fullness of joy, and you're there, and you've got it. And that somehow handles all of the other stuff. Does it mean you didn't care? No, it means you got God. Does the fact that you enjoy the joy that is in the presence of God mean that you didn't really care about them and now they're in hell and you still don't care? No, it doesn't mean that at all. It does mean, though, that the active presence of God in your soul has a compensating joy production that will enable you to endure the loss without being overwhelmed by the grief. That's the essence, I think, of Hebrews' statement that Jesus, for the joy set before him, endured the cross. He didn't want to go there. And if my understanding of the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross that has eternal ramifications, that he really never gets out of this loop in a final sense, then you have to have some kind of a compensatory reality. And I believe the Bible says that for the Son of God, for the Spirit of God, and for every created angel who has not sinned, and every human being who has been redeemed, the reality for them is that by the nature of their being, the presence of God without barrier to them will compensate beyond the losses to joy. And I believe it's possible to have joy in the presence of grief. I think that Jesus probably is, if I can say it this way without being an idolater, I think Jesus is doomed for all eternity to have to deal with the grief of separation from his Father for the sins of human beings, at the same time experiencing the joy that is in the presence of the Father with him. It's a both-and thing, not an either-or. I think most of us spend most of our life trying to make it an either-or so that we can get out of this in order to get into this. And God says, no, that's not how it works. You don't get out of this, but you do get into this, and therefore you can have more joy than you have grief, and that'll help. But that does bring back then the question of the fear. What would the actual experience be for someone whose experience of hell was set in the context of the deepest satisfaction of the soul? What would Paul's experience in his soul have been if God had agreed to let him be the sacrifice for the sins of his brethren and sent him into hell for their sakes and taken them into heaven for his sake because he was the sacrifice? What would the condition of his soul been? He would have gotten what he wanted. That has to be possible. So, when love's in the mix, the circumstances tend to get dismissed in terms of their impact. If at the bottom level of your love there is a selflessness that seeks the benefit of somebody else and God allows you to be the sacrifice for that person's sake and that's really what you wanted, you can't be described as enduring hell at the level of your soul because it's not there. You've got what you wanted in a very positive way. So, when Paul says, I'm afraid, what is he afraid of? Well, in the sense that he's afraid that his labor will be ineffective, it means he's afraid they're going to prove to be people who Luke would have described as having believed for a little while. He's afraid that they may prove to be those whose commitment to truth was just a flash in the pan. He's already said, if you proclaim a false gospel, you're going to be accursed. They had embraced the true gospel, but now they were being persuaded that the true gospel is not true and the false gospel is. And it's a small step, as we've said many, many times, from being persuaded that this false gospel is true and preaching it. But if you proclaim it, you're cursed. So Paul's fear is that all of this effort he put into convincing them that the gospel of the grace of God was the truth would be wiped out by their decision to walk away, to re-embrace the vomit. So, in a sense, then, the issue of ineffective labors in regard to the Galatians for Paul is, to some degree, about what happens to those who make those labors vain. In other words, his fear is as the New American Standard translates it. He is afraid for them. He's afraid that they're going to perish. He's afraid of what's going to happen to them if they walk away from the grace of God. He's afraid. And in the context, what exactly he's afraid of is in relation to what his labors were supposed to accomplish. What had he sought to accomplish by his labors? Well, in the context of Galatians, what he had sought to accomplish was the formation of Christ in them so that they could be justified before the Father. That was the point of his preaching. He came preaching Christ crucified so that by faith you could be declared righteous before God. That's what he wanted. Okay, if that proves to be ineffective, then what he's getting is people who haven't believed that, but don't believe that, who have rejected that. So Paul's labors were supposed to accomplish their justification, and they are on the verge of proving that his labors were fruitless. Paul had designed his labors according to the way God had defined his labors, and that is to get the Galatians to believe God so that they could be justified by God, so that the potential for the joy of life was actually set into motion. He wanted to get them to step over the threshold of grace, so the joy of life would be their experience. That's not to say that he didn't care about what might happen to them down the line as believers. But that's really not the focus of these two chapters of Galatians. That comes into focus in chapters 5 and 6, where he talks about what happens to believers who give themselves over to the flesh. If you bite and devour, be careful, you might get chewed up. Don't be deceived. God's not mocked. You sow it, you'll reap it. Be careful how you live. If you live by the Spirit, then walk by the Spirit, because if you live by the flesh... So it's not to say that Paul's not interested in their sanctification, but in these two chapters and early on, the issue is whether they have believed the gospel so that they could be justified. And that implies that his fear is not what's going to happen to them as post-justification believers. His fear is that they haven't believed it. And therefore, they will not be justified. And therefore, they will not experience life. They'll perish. So that's what he's afraid of. Why is he afraid of that? Verse 10. Back up one step. He claims he's afraid that they have not been justified, and that that will mean that they will perish forever. His bottom line fear is that they're going to perish forever. One step above that is he's afraid they haven't believed the gospel, because that would keep them from perishing. The next level up is he's afraid that his labor has been in vain, because if his labor had been effective, they'd have believed the gospel. If they'd have believed the gospel, they'd have entered into life, and then they wouldn't go to hell. So that's why I say it's always layered. But how can Paul make this comment about them? How can he be so afraid that they're going to perish, given the fact that he has already said in verse 8 that there was a then, and verse 9, and there is a now? If he believes that they have been known by God, how can he be afraid? Well, I already said earlier in a previous study, I think it was probably last week, that verse 11 makes verses 8 and 9 an assumed position without firm confidence that it's true. It's firmly true if it's true. There was a then and there is a now. But if the then is still the now, and the now doesn't really exist because the profession of faith has just been lip service to this point, if the now isn't the now, then he's afraid. And that's where he's being ambivalent in this paragraph. He doesn't know exactly where they are. The manifestation of the problem, according to Paul, consists in the fact that they observe days and months and seasons and years. You say, well, how is that such a problem? Well, twofold, maybe three. But at least on the first step, the statement you observe, that verb means that you so meticulously observe a thing that you don't let anything escape your notice. It's used, for example, of a guard watching a gate or a place where a certain person might be able to escape from being held. And this guard is so afraid that the prisoner will escape that he's watching this route of escape, and he's watching carefully, and he's making sure that the shifting shadows and the movements and all that are not the prisoner getting away. He's fixed on it. He's very carefully observing it. The word is used of Jesus' opponents when they would watch Jesus to see if they could catch him in some word or some action that would enable them to nail his hide to the wall. They listened to everything he said, hoping against hope that he'd hang himself, and they'd be there to catch it. Every word, every action, they were watching it. And that means that to say, you're watching days and months and seasons and years like this, he's saying they're obsessed. They have made an obsessive commitment to observing days, months, and seasons and years. Well, what's wrong with that? First of all, what's wrong with it is that those religious practices had never been assigned to them. They're Gentiles. It's true that under judicial Mosaic law, you had to observe certain days of the year, and you had to observe certain months, you had to observe certain seasons, and you had to observe certain years. And your observance of these things held some pretty significant repercussions if you failed. For example, one of the requirements was the observance of the sabbatical year. Every seventh year, you were not supposed to plant your fields. It was called a Sabbath, a sabbatical year. You were supposed to let the land lie fallow for that year. And that meant that you had to trust that the harvest of the sixth year would carry you through the planting and growth period of the eighth year, so that by the time the harvest of the eighth year came, you had not run out of food that had been harvested in the sixth year. That meant you had to believe that God would provide with more in the sixth year that would carry you into the end of the eighth year, so that you could observe the seventh year. But if you didn't think you'd harvested enough at the end of the sixth year, you'd be tempted to plant the seventh year because you might not make it to the eighth year if you don't. So there were these sabbatical years. And every seven cycles of that, there was a year jubilee. So that every 50th year, you had to observe the 49th year as a Sabbath and the 50th year as a Sabbath. And that meant that the harvest of the 48th year had to carry you into the 51st year. And if you were afraid the harvest of the sixth wouldn't get you into the eighth, you're certainly not going to wait 2 years. Goodness. So what the effective result of that was is that Israel just totally ignored that for 490 years. And that meant they owed the land 70 years of rest. So God says, guess what, folks? You're going to Babylon for 70 years until the land gets its rest. So ignore the seasons, the days, the months, the year. Ignore them at your peril. There's a consequence kicking in here. If it has been assigned to you to do that. But the Gentiles have never been assigned days and months and seasons and years by God. So for them to observe days and months and seasons and years means they've embraced the Jewish calendar now. They're obsessed about this that God has never told them to do. Now, why would somebody be obsessive about something that God's never assigned them to do? Well, there are only a couple reasons. The first being that they have been persuaded by somebody that God did assess it. They are now obligated. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, you have to believe that he was the Jewish Christ. And that means you have to come under the Jewish rule. And that means you have to keep the Jewish rules. And that means you have to start observing the days and the months and the seasons and the years. So it is assigned to you by God. And then the second thing has got to be, okay, you've been assessed this. Why are you going to do it? Well, because it's the only way I can get what I want out of it. I don't want to be hammered. So I'm going to keep it. Well, that's what Paul is saying. The idea that you can satisfy God's judicial demands on you by your obedience is fundamentally flawed at the level of the fact that your obedience can never be as complete as God wants. Therefore, for you to say, I will get what I want out of this because I'm keeping God's words according to his instruction, he will say, you didn't, and therefore you can't. So, their observance of days and months and seasons and years was as futile as Paul's fear that his labors among them had been. In other words, they weren't going to get what they wanted. But really, what is the issue of this final level of futility at its core? Why does a person yield to legal demandingness from a God who says, obey me and you can live? What is the bottom line here? Well, the bottom line is, I don't want to die. I've got to obey in order to keep from dying. I'm going to commit myself to obedience so that I won't die. How different is that from Paul's, you need somebody to die for somebody? Hey, I'll volunteer. How different is, I volunteer, from, oh, I don't want to die, I don't want to die. 180 degrees out of joint here. One of them is operating out of love, I'll do it for somebody else. The other one is totally self-focused. Okay, if you're totally self-focused, how can you ever do anything that is required in the love of God? You're just doing it for yourself. If you're just doing it for yourself, will God ever give you credit for having done anything righteous? He'll say, no, I'm selfish. That's ungodly. That's unrighteous. No, that won't pass muster. So, bottom line, people who are obsessed on rule-keeping are people who are still so afraid that God's promise of life on the basis of faith is not true, that they're going to try to make it happen for them. And that means they're still trying to run the show. I am not going to turn my eternal destiny over to God. He may not let me have what I want out of that. If I do that, I'm not doing it. If I want to have eternal life, it's basically going to be up to me to get it. Because I can't trust God to give it to me. That's the issue. And quite frankly, folks, this is why everybody's so terrified of doctrines like predestination and election and all. Because they're scared to death that maybe God didn't elect them. Or predestined them to life. And in their terror, they're, I can't stand a God like that. Woo, get out of here. Well, what's that mean? Who do you want to be God? Oh, I'll volunteer. Let me run the show. That way things will work out the way I want them to. That's what Paul's basic issue here in these two verses is. I know, he says, that you are turning away from the God of grace back to the weak and beggarly things because I see you obsessively convinced that it will be by your actions that you get what you want out of life. And if that's the way you believe, you have departed from the grace of God. Under the thesis of the grace of God, you will get what God promises you as you trust him. If you trust him, you will get it. That's the promise, and that's the issue, faith. If you don't believe that, then you can't go to the promise. You have to go somewhere else. And Paul says, I know that you have turned back to the weak and beggarly elements because before you knew God, that's exactly what you were doing. You were trying to manipulate the gods to get what you wanted out of life. And now you're just using a Jewish form of that, an obsessive keeping of rules that were never imposed on you. And that proves to me that what you're involved in here is not relating to God on the basis of His grace. It's relating to Him on the basis of, you owe me because I've done my part. That way I can control the outcome. And in a very real sense, that's just a system in which people attempt to leverage God so that they can get out of Him what they want. And that's just as Luciferian as it can be. That's what the devil instituted in the beginning. I want to run the show, he said. Why? Well, then I'll get what I want. Well, what about the rest of us? Who gives a flip about the rest of you? Well, would you send your son to die for us so that we could have it? Nah, I ain't going to send nobody to die for you. As long as I get what I want, I'm satisfied. That's the difference in the two gods, Lucifer and the true God. So when Paul winds this paragraph up with his statements about their obsession and his fears, he's simply telling them, look, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt in verses 8 and 9. There was a before setting that you agreed to when I came into your midst preaching the gospel. You didn't like what you were experiencing then. And you told me that you liked what you got when you believed in the grace of God, when you believed in Christ crucified. But now you're obsessively rule-keeping again, proving that you really don't believe that God's going to come across with the goods, because the promises to you are not believable. You're going to make them happen. That tells me that you've gone back to the weak and beggarly things, and I'm afraid that my labor has been wasted. Not that I'm afraid that my labor's been wasted, but I'm afraid of what's going to happen to you.